You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert. What does it take to make a tyrant? This question became a major consumption of psychologists and historians in the 20th century who were looking at figures like Hitler and Stalin and asking to what extent they were products of history and to what extent they were individuals who shaped it. It's also been a major concern for the U.S. government, which makes major investments in developing psychological profiles of foreign leaders it has to deal with or manipulate. And most recently, it's become a fixation of people looking at our own government. There has been a proliferation of remote psychological diagnoses of President Donald Trump since he assumed office. Our next guest has just devoted an entire book to the history and the tools of psychological profiling, where they work, where they reach their limits, and what they tell us about history's tyrants. Dean Haycock is a neurobiologist and a science writer. His new book is Tyrannical Minds, Psychological Profiling, Narcissism, and Dictatorship. Thanks for joining us.
It's good to be here.
So why this book? Why devote a book to the psychology of tyrants?
I think it was a selfish start. Since I was very, very young, I just could not get my head around this concept of a man like Adolf Hitler. And I think for years and years, I just pondered this issue and read. And finally, after half a century, I began to study it very, very carefully. And finally, I have some idea of how people like Adolf Hitler and Stalin and Mao Zedong, how they're motivated and how they come to power. And it's not as mysterious as it was for me when I was 11 years old and trying to figure out how such a man could exist. So basically, it was to satisfy my own curiosity.
So there's kind of two separate questions there, right? There's like, how does a figure like Adolf Hitler rise to power in his society and political system? And the second question is, with his hands on the reins of power, why does he commit his nation to such a cruel and genocidal course of action? There's plenty of evidence in the military history that the resources he devoted to genocide actually hurt Germany's war effort.
Yeah, it's a very good point. When I started this book, I was thinking mostly of the psychological aspects of these dictators or tyrants. And then it became very clear that there are a lot of people with dark traits like this. And it takes a confluence of events and events in history and sociology and society, I mean, and in the development of the person. And they all have to come together to provide an opportunity for these people to take power. So just the psychology enough is not enough to explain the emergence of these people.
So let's start with maybe Hitler's genesis as a person, his kind of psychological formation, and then let's talk about the context that enabled him, or at least the best theories we have about those two things now. How would a psychological profiler understand Hitler as a person?
All you can do, since it was never possible to put him down on a couch, is to examine all the information you can find. And this is what Walter Langer did when he was asked by Wild Bill Donovan of the OSS to do this. Gather every bit of written material you can, films, propaganda material, interviews with people who knew him. This is difficult because you're never sure sometimes of the validity of these things. But overall, these profilers can get pattern and see it. And that's what Langer did in World War II. Langer was a psychoanalyst, a PhD from Harvard, who was a follower of Sigmund Freud. And although Freudian psychology is, you know, widely criticized and pretty much discounted from many of its elements, not all, Langer was nevertheless able to get a very accurate picture of Hitler in terms of how the man would respond in adverse situations. By examining all this information and combining it with his knowledge of human behavior, he was able to predict how Hitler would respond. And he accurately predicted of all the things he might do as the war came to the end that Hitler would commit suicide. That insight and success encouraged the CIA and other government agencies and countries to take very seriously this idea of psychologically profiling foreign leaders.
Well, let me follow up on that before I circle back to it. Like, what's the practical utility of knowing whether or not Hitler is likely to commit suicide as Allied forces advance? They still have to organize a successful war effort, right?
They do. But if Hitler was a different type of person and was committed to leading his troops no matter what happened, if he was willing to flee from his bunker into South Germany, into the mountains, and continue the fight as a guerrilla warrior, as Mao Zedong would have done, for instance, that would have had a significant effect on the American war effort. If he had committed himself to trying to make a separate peace, for instance, as things degenerated for the German war effort, that too could have had significant political ramifications. So I doubt very much if Langer's analysis of Hitler affected U.S. policy. As I said, it encouraged intelligence agencies and psychologists to begin trying to expand this program of psychological profiling. So in the future, governments would have better insight into how a foreign leader might respond in negotiations or how they might respond to a threat to their rule.
Yeah, this is tools of psychology devoted to a very practical question, right? Which is, how is this enemy forces leader going to respond as the war winds down? It leaves aside the kind of bigger moral and philosophical questions that torment so many academics and public thinkers for most of the rest of the 20th century, which is like, how did society produce an Adolf Hitler, someone who would preside over the execution of some 6 million Jews during the Holocaust?
And here, that's where you delve deep into the concepts of the dark psychological traits. You know, you're probably familiar with malignant narcissism and the dark triad of Machiavellianism, psychopathy, and narcissism. And these people who have these very dark psychological traits don't function on the same wavelength as those of us who don't have these traits do. So in order to get something done, taking a life doesn't matter. It's a step towards achieving a goal. And unfortunately, there are lots of people in the world who are like this. And when someone like Hitler, who incidentally also believed he was, as stated in Mein Kampf, his memoir, that he was chosen by Providence to lead Germany, to make Germany great again. After World War I, as you know, the country was just crushed, and there was economic strife. The French and the Allies were bleeding the country with reparation demands for money, and Hitler stepped in and said, I can solve these problems. Only I can solve these problems. And it resonated with these people. So that combination of the social situation with a man who had malignant narcissistic traits and the belief that he was destined to greatness came together, unfortunately, at that time. And the danger is, of course, we have to keep an eye out for now and in the future of, can these things happen again, or are these things happening again around the world?
It seems to me like Hitler is a special case. You can look at the millions of lives that Joseph Stalin was responsible for taking in the Soviet Union and say there was at least a logic of power to taking those lives. He was purging people he perceived as threats to his control over the government of the Soviet Union early on. He was sending people who were believed to be dissidents to the Gulag archipelago. He was imposing his discipline over a vast area. The Holocaust, the extermination of the Jews, seems almost incidental to Hitler's requirements to maintain control and expand Germany's borders.
In World War II, the Jews were the, quote, others. And Hitler built his whole policy on blaming Jews worldwide for the troubles in Germany. We don't know you know, psychologically why he hated the Jews so much. There's different theories, but I don't think any of them have been proven very well. I mean, the doctor, for instance, who took care of his mother was Jewish and was given special treatment consideration while other Jews were being slaughtered. So that, I think one possible explanation is that they were just the group of people for the Germans to, or for the Nazis rather, to target, to keep the population's minds off of other problems. They were the entire problem. As I said, there are theories about why Hitler hated the Jews so much. It is known that anti-Semitism in Germany before World War I was very strong. And when Hitler was a young man living in Vienna, there was a great deal of anti-Semitic literature. And he was just steeped in that as he was a young man after the death of his mother in his early 20s. And he absorbed that. Perhaps it's a combination of exploiting that and actually blaming those people for not only his failures, but for the difficulties that Germany was in after it lost World War I.
It seems to me there's another problem tangled up in reducing tyrants to their psychological traits, and that is distinguishing the traits they brought with them to the office versus those that are developed by holding the office under the circumstances they do. Someone who's leading a big state is under an immense amount of pressure. There's plenty of studies now showing that ability to empathize with others drops with wealth and power.
Yeah, I've seen that, yes.
How do we know that it's, you know, psychopathic Machiavellian narcissists who make tyrants and not political systems with concentrated power at the top that make psychopathic narcissists?
Well, because they have these traits as they're coming up. Stalin was an incredibly intelligent, nasty individual as he was moving up to gain power. The only difference I can tell in all the biographies I read is that Stalin's paranoia became greater as he was in power. But a little bit of paranoia in a tyrant is a good thing for the tyrant because it can keep them alive. One historian said, if you weren't paranoid in the Kremlin, there was something wrong with you. These people show these traits. They can't get to the top without having psychopathic and malignant narcissistic traits. Nice guys don't get to be leaders of Soviet Union and Nazi Germany. They have to kill on the way up. They have to manipulate on the way up. And once they're there, they don't change. But again, the fear that they will be toppled or assassinated begins to play a big role. And at the end of their lives, it can become a serious problem for both Mao Zedong. There's examples of this, and for Stalin. There's a very interesting part of Nikita Khrushchev's memoirs where he describes the story where Stalin invited Khrushchev and another Soviet leader to a summer house. And Khrushchev remembers that one day Stalin walked out front of the house and stood in the yard, and Khrushchev hurried to join him. And Stalin looked at Khrushchev and said, "I don't trust anybody. I don't even trust myself." And Khrushchev was speechless after that. And finally, after a silence, he changed the subject. But Khrushchev attributed a lot of the terrors of Stalin to that paranoia, which appears to have gotten worse as the man aged, which is you know, not particularly surprising. So these guys have these dark traits as they're coming up, and they have them as they're ruling. And sometimes the paranoia gets to be a serious problem for them, for their rule. Mao Zedong also, according to the memoir of his doctor, became quite paranoid towards the end, changing houses frequently, thinking certain rooms posed a threat to him. So it's very difficult, you know, to maintain an even keel, knowing that so many people want to change your position.
Speaking to Dean Haycock, he's a neurobiologist and a science writer who's just out with a book entitled Tyrannical Minds, Psychological Profiling, Narcissism, and dictatorship. So we've talked a lot about the traits of the people in these offices. We haven't spoken much about the enabling circumstances that let them rise to power in the first place. So, like, what does the post-Lenin Soviet Union and the post-World War I Weimar Republic have in common? Why are they both able to give rise to such powerful tyrants?
Well, great uncertainty and unhappiness with the preceding situation, economic strife, anything that makes people feel unsafe. It seems history teaches us that they look for someone who can make them feel safer. Someone who says, I can solve these problems. It's interesting. I'm glad you asked that question because as I was writing this book, I realized the main concern is not necessarily the psychopathology of the tyrants, is what makes their ascent possible. And the problem is when society is hurt, there's a certain number of people in the population that look for very easy answers, and they look for them in a very strong individual. And that happened in both of those instances. The Russian Revolution was a little different. It was, you know, obviously an attempt to overthrow the Tsar, which was successful. But then Lenin took charge. And Lenin himself was very tyrannical, not so much as Stalin, but he set the tone. And then the competition within the Bolsheviks, later became the communists, just led to that Stalinist era. But the Russian people were miserable under the Tsars, and they remained miserable, I think, under Stalinism for the most part, but they had a very strong leader, and they didn't have any choice of changing that leadership. The case in Germany, the country was just, you know, destitute and down, and Hitler offered solutions. He offered to make, as I said, to make Germany great again. And if enough members of the population believe this and are willing to not analyze what such a person or a party is offering, then that party can prosper. And in the case of China, China was broken apart, governed by warlords. It was a chaotic situation, and Mao, with his guerrilla army, was able to exploit that situation and come out on top and then retain power with help of his dark psychological traits and attributes.
Well, then let's try to carry those generalizations forward to our present circumstances. You have two chapters devoted to Donald J. Trump, who won't surprise our listeners to hear. Many psychologists feel displays that triad of personality traits, narcissism, mm-hmm. psychopathy, Machiavellianism. He rises to power in a country that is in the midst of an economic boom, a country that's considered to have relatively robust democratic institutions. It is not a war-torn, balkanized China. It is not in the social upheaval of post-revolutionary Soviet Union. It's not suffering through the kind of economic depredation of post-war Germany. So how would we explain Donald Trump's rise to power?
Well, that's a lot to explain. One is Trump is not in the category of Hitler or Stalin or Mao. There's huge differences, and I'm not a psychiatrist or a psychologist, so I wouldn't diagnose anyone. The reason, and also I'd say that, you know, Donald Trump is not a fascist. The reason he's in the book is because of the psychiatrists and the psychologists who began speaking out, suggesting that he did, in fact, have psychological traits that created problems for the country. So because I was writing a book on psychological profiling, I had to address that. So in the book, I describe what the psychiatrists and psychologists who believe he poses a threat because of his psychological makeup. And I also describe those, the views of the psychiatrist and psychologist who don't believe he has a personality disorder or believe he does not have a personality disorder. So generally, I try to present the case of Donald Trump as someone who is definitely narcissistic. Even the people, the psychiatrists who criticize their peers for attempting to diagnose Mr. Trump, they admit he's extremely narcissistic. And then from there, you can describe a lot of attributes and obviously see them and predict behavior. But it's a complex problem with Donald Trump. I would never put him on the same level, obviously, as these other, as Hitler's and Stalin's and Mao's and Idi Amin and those types. Across the world now, right-leaning authoritarians are becoming very popular. That is a factor in Donald Trump's election. I sought out people who voted for Donald Trump because his standards are so different than previous presidents. And that was very insightful. Understanding those people is even more important than understanding Donald Trump, because without them, you would not have elected a president who tries to create a threat from immigrants that's certainly exaggerated. And I wouldn't describe him in the same terms as the other three. I included him in the book because he was being profiled by mental health professionals in the country and then examined what the implications of those profiles were.
Well, that's a good note to end on when discussing the book. Dean Haycock, I really appreciate your time.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Dean Haycock is a neurobiologist and a science writer. His new book is Tyrannical Minds: Psychological Profiling, Narcissism, and Dictatorship. Well, that takes us to a little bit before 7:56 in the morning here at KPFA 94.1 FM in Berkeley, KPFB 89.3 FM in Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 FM in Fresno, K24 8BR 97.5 FM in Santa Cruz, and online around the world at www.kpfa.org. The program's up front. My name's Brian Edwards-Tiekert. Kat Brooks is back next week, but she's going to be on tape in the next hour speaking to Albert Woodfox. Before that, I want to give you a quick look at what is happening on the stage. Our own Richard Walensky has this review of John Leguizamo's Kiss My Aztec, running at the Berkeley Rep through Sunday, July 14th.